Ali Habib with our American Stories, and it's now time for our This Day in History segment, brought to us, as always, by Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. In this piece, we are going to go back in American time to discover some states that united to ban a certain carnal practice within the walls of enlightenment and instruction. Let's take a listen.
Oh, wow, man. Wait a second, man. What do you think the teacher's going to look like this year?
Hot for Teacher may have been a major hit for Van Halen back in 1984. But the very idea of a personal relationship between teacher and student was nothing to sing about for Ohio lawmakers back in the 19th century. Well, teacher needs to see me after school. On April 22, 1886, the Buckeye State passed a law that made it illegal for any man over the age of 21 to put the moves on a woman he was instructing. Those who dared would face the possibility of spending up to a decade in the clink. To be clear, while the statute quite rightly made it illegal for an adult male teacher to engage in an inappropriate relationship with one of his young students, the wide latitude of the law went far beyond that, stating, "A male person over 21 years of age who is superintendent, tutor, or teacher in a private, parochial, or public school, or seminary, or other public institution, or instructor of any female in music, dancing, roller skating, athletic exercise, or any branch of learning, who has sexual intercourse at any time or place with any female with her consent, while under his instruction during the term of his engagement, shall be imprisoned in the penitentiary not more than 10 years, nor less than 2. Translate that to today's standards, and what it means is that even if you're an unmarried 30-something looking for Mr. Wright, you'd be wise to keep your hands off your personal trainer, lest he be arrested for reciprocating your romantic interests. And yes, the same goes for your roller skating instructor." Oh my God! But Ohio was hardly the first state to pass such a law. In Virginia, dangling the prospect of marriage as a way to hook up was a no-no with any unmarried female of previous chaste character, and again punishable by up to 10 years in prison. The lawmakers were generous enough to note that the chastity of the female shall be presumed in the absence of evidence to the contrary. New York instituted a similar law in 1848, but considered the crime a misdemeanor, whereas Virginia classified it as a felony. Georgia, too, had a seduction law, which reads very Jackie Collins-esque, with phrases like, "Seduce a virtuous unmarried female, and induce her to yield to his lustful embraces, and allow him to have carnal knowledge of her."
Hey, Hazel, look who's gone out to look for a husband.
Any man charged with the crime had one of two choices.
If you ask me, the poor old thing couldn't catch a husband with a bear trap.
Take his chances in court and risk spending 2 to 20 years in prison. Or marry the gal.
Happy husband hunting, dearie.
Did you take something with you to clunk him on the head with?
The written law noted that the prosecution may be stopped at any time by the marriage of the parties, or a bona fide and continuing offer to marry on the part of the seducer, which was certainly one way to snag a husband.
Now let's hear your side of the story, sister.
Well,
I know just what you're gonna say. You're looking for a husband.
Yes.
Well, you're going about it all wrong, girlie. You don't bat him on the bean with a rolling pin. That comes later.
Oh.
In fact, on some occasions, women did use these laws in order to coerce men into marriage.
Oh, he's chasing me!
A New York man in the middle of an 1867 trial that was headed toward conviction proposed to the alleged victim. The local minister was summoned, and the trial instantly became a marriage ceremony.
What do you got in the market basket, dearie? A husband?
Yeah, I'll say yes.
These laws were only sporadically enforced, but a few men were actually prosecuted and convicted. In Michigan, a man was convicted of 3 counts of seduction, but the appeals court did everything in its power to overturn the decision. It threw out 2 charges because the defense reasoned that the woman was no longer virtuous after the couple's first encounter. The other charge was overturned after the defense claimed that the woman's testimony that they had hooked up in a buggy was medically impossible. Nothing like a little medical science to prove the infeasible fruits of seduction.
Yeah. We're no strangers to love.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we like looking back at the culture. And great job on that, Greg. And, you know, I always think of just how sophisticated all those old cartoons used to be, because we're sitting here laughing. And those cartoons weren't just for kids. They were for adults. Again, this is Lee Habib, This Day in History, brought to you, as always, by Hillsdale College. Go to hillsdale.edu to catch their great online courses. More after these messages. And this is Our American Stories, and we cover all kinds of stories on this show. And we've been dipping into the prison system on a couple of angles, and one of them is the prison reform movement that's happening in the unlikeliest of places, in the southern states and in a lot of the red states, states that one wouldn't think there'd be sympathy for what's happening to people caught in the criminal justice system and those lives in there, because there are human beings in these prisons, and we care about them. And we played a video last week. Judge Verda Colvin, and she's a Bibb County Sheriff Office's, part of a Bibb County Sheriff Office's Consider the Consequences program. She's a Superior Court judge. And, well, in this particular video, which went absolutely viral, she's just getting in the grill of some young people and trying to shake them out of the patterns of behavior that she knows will lead them into her courtroom and, in the end, to prison. Let's listen to some of that video.
Stop acting like you're trash and putting pictures of yourself on the internet. Stop being disrespectful to your peers. Care about your future. Be somebody. Anybody can be nothing. It doesn't take anything to be nothing. Be something. Do you understand what I'm saying? Care about yourselves. The fact that you're shedding tears means you want to be better and you want to do better. Do it. The only person stopping you is you. Do better than what you've been doing. Do you understand me? Do you understand me? I don't expect to ever see the 3 of you all back in my courtroom like this. One day I want you to come tell me. Judge Colvin, when I got gray in my hair, because I can't even color it anymore because it's so much gray, I want you to come tell me. Judge Colvin, I graduated from college. You might not remember me, but back in 2016, you said something to me to make a difference. I am sick and tired of seeing people who look like you and I come in my courtroom and I have to sentence them to prison. And then you hear them fussing on TV about African Americans being in the prison system. Well, guess what? If you don't do what it takes to go there, you won't be a part of it.
That's right. And, you know, we're almost smiling and shaking our heads. And I think all around this country. And obviously, Judge Verda Colvin is African-American, if you've seen the video. But this applies to everybody. This is beyond race. All these discussions now. So many of them are. And so we had to get to know this woman better. And our field correspondent, Alex Cortez, chased down this Superior Court judge. Again, Judge Verda Colvin. And, well, the interview started out with Judge Colvin talking about her early life, her faith, and how it shaped the philosophy. And this is a philosopher, and a moral philosopher in her courtroom, how that philosophy is used and deployed in her courtroom every day.
Tell us where you grew up and what your childhood was like.
I grew up in Atlanta, Metro Atlanta, moved to different parts of Metro Atlanta, but Southwest Atlanta is where I consider the bulk of my growing up to have taken place. Went to public high school there, Thero High School, raised by my parents, who divorced when I was six, so raised by my mom. I was fortunate that my dad was a constant in my life, so he exercised his visitation rights and pretty much came every other weekend until I became 14 and he moved to Charlotte for a promotion. And I think I grew up like most kids in a suburban area with all the issues that you can have. My mom, neither of my parents are college educated, so I was the first in my immediate family to go to college. But I think I grew up like most children do, like middle America does, and I didn't have any of the advantages that would take me out of the realm of dealing with the realities. But I will tell you, my mom worked in food service for Coca-Cola, and so she didn't make that much, but, you know, I never was thought to think in terms of lack, and so I never thought about what I had or didn't have. I pretty much had what most kids had in that area. So I think I grew up with a very normal childhood that most kids can relate to.
Do you feel like the divorce impacted you at any way, or at age six was it?
Of course. I think we lie to ourselves if we don't acknowledge that divorce impacts everybody in a family, and especially kids. I think it's normal for kids to go through the thought process of, you know, did I contribute to that? Does it somehow define who or what I can become? Because anytime you have what appears to be less than, you always think somehow that may color what your future can be. And so I think that's a reality that we have to face, but that's why I think it's so important for adults to be very honest and candid with children, because if you deal with those issues with a kid, they get it. Like, this is not about you. It's about two adults who decided that it was best for everybody that they go their separate ways. But we love you to death, and we think the world of you. And when they operate in a way that makes kids know that, then even though their world may not in their minds be perfect, because as adults we know no world is perfect, but as a kid you think, if I have a home with two parents in it, my world will be perfect. Well, growing up, a lot of kids in those two parents' home understand it's not perfect. But when adults kind of gather around children and they work together to make it the best situation possible, then kids can feel whole. So I knew my father cared about me. I knew my mom cared about me because he was a constant in my life, and so that helped. So I recognize that when kids don't have that parent who's not there as a constant coming by every weekend or every other weekend, that's another issue that they have.
How much of these problems you see in your court would you attribute, to the divorce or the lack of fathers in these kids' lives?
It says everything, but I will be candid with you. Some of these kids who come in my courtroom have both parents in the home. So, you know, that was really shocking to me at some point during this journey, because we've been doing this since May of 2015. But it just goes, you know, what I said to myself when I saw that was, it goes to reason what, you know, maybe my parents told me growing up, that no one has a perfect life. Even when you ideally have all the components there that society says you should have to make for this ideal life, no one has an ideal life. Everyone is riddled with problems because we're human beings with frailties. And so it just goes to show that there are common problems throughout our country across whatever echelon you might find yourself in. And children don't experience anything different than adults experience, which is life can be rough and it can be hard. But I will tell you, I think it makes it harder when both parents aren't pouring into the child. I think it makes it harder when one or two parents have so many personal issues that they can't devote the attention to the child. And then I think a lot of it has to do with societal failures. I mean, it's all about things and stuff and appearances. And we don't concentrate on working on the inside. So how do we expect these kids to then concentrate on working on the inside? I recognize that a lot of what they haven't, they're not getting, we all are part of that. We all have some fault in that.
And what they get in the inside, I believe you're a person of faith. Where did you get that faith? What is it, and what has it meant to your life?
Everything. It defines, it refines, it identifies everything I am. And I will tell you, when I was a little girl, my mom, and because I guess she always wanted me to excel in ways that she wasn't able to because of her generation and the time she came from, she wanted me to be in private school, private religious school. And so I think initially she and my dad had some angst about that because, you know, that was money coming out the household, but my mom believed in it strongly. And so she enrolled me in private religious school that happened to be Seventh-day Adventist, although we were never Seventh-day Adventists, at least my mom and I, my father weren't. But she wrote me in that school because she heard a lot of good things about it. In fact, I think her best friend from high school, who graduated number one, at some point went to that school. So she enrolled me in private religious school. And I remember in first grade, the teacher I had, she was so extraordinary. Her name was Mrs. Jones, and she taught us lessons regarding morality and how we should try to live our lives and the kind of person we could be. And when I say morality, I don't want to give the appearance of it being what people equate to it now. She was talking about how we should conduct ourselves and live our lives and act as the best people we can be and really serve others. And so that stayed with me. I guess I was like a sponge. And from the first grade, I knew I wanted to do something where I really gave back to people. And that just kind of fueled my energy all throughout my life.
Man, the first grade, that's early.
And when we come back, more with Alex and Judge Verda Colvin. And what a voice. What a straight, simple voice. Here at Our American Stories, there's no part of American life we don't touch. A judge, a Superior Court judge, not on television. We don't want those fake judges. This is a real-life judge with real-life human beings, young people, that she's trying to help stay out of prison. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and we continue Alex Cortez's correspondence and conversation with Judge Verda Colvin.
Is there any moments in your young life that you look back now and see that it really shaped you? I mean, even moments that could have been really trying at the time, but have really shaped who you are as a person now and what you've brought to those kids in that court?
You know, I don't remember moments per se, but I remember people making impact. So Mrs. Jones in first grade, I talked to one of my high school teachers, Miss Burke, from high school. She was extremely proud, very assured of herself. And most of my life, particularly as a child, I was always a little unsure of my place, whether I was good enough, whether I could do the things that I wanted to do. And in high school, she didn't ask us what we felt about ourselves. She told us how we should feel about ourselves. And I told her the other day when she called me, I told her, I said, thank you for that confidence you gave me. And she kind of mimicked what my mom gave me throughout my life. My mom would always say to me, anything you want to do, the only thing you have to say is you want to do it. And even though she wasn't very educated, my mom would sit there with me as I struggled over math problems, and she said, I can't help you, but I know you can do it. I know what you can do. And having someone feed that into my spirit about me being capable and able, I will tell you, Ms. Cortez, that has driven me throughout my life, because whenever I face things personal or professional that seem insurmountable, I hear those voices. I hear the Miss Burke of the world, the Miss Jones of the world, my mom saying, you can do anything. If it can be conceived, you can do it. And so that same drive that they gave me without even knowing how much I guess they were pouring into me, that's what I try to do with these kids, because I really believe that. I believe gifts, and we all have special things that have been poured into us inherently, and we just have to tap in and get those gifts. And it's enough space in the world for everybody to be successful with their gifts. And I try to, you know, even when I'm not talking with kids, even in my narcotics court, I try to tell that to adults too, because they're really, I say this all the time, to me, adults are basically grown children trying to work out their issues. Because, you know, we grow up with whatever issues we get as children. And so we're trying to work those out. So we still need that inspiration. We still need that someone whispering in our ears that our dreams are achievable. Mm. And so those are the people that drive me. So not a particular aha moment, but all of those people that I come in contact who move me. Every time I've heard a speech or a sermon or something that has inspired me to think, we are greater than what we realize we are, because we're here. That's inspired me to be further challenged and inspired. And so I guess all of those things combined have helped make me who I am. But you're right. I think at the core of all of that is my deep spiritual thought that all of us are so special and so important. And if we really got that, can you imagine what we could be as a society? I don't consider myself religious, but I do consider myself spiritual. And so when you reach to the depth of your spirituality, each individual, you're capable of greatness.
You talked about that teacher who told you how you should feel about yourselves, and that seems to be exactly what you're doing with these kids and how they matter and don't define themselves by their sexuality and all these kinds of things. Talk about the minds of these young kids in America today. What's kind of generally wrong with the culture, and how do you think we can actually, you know, tap into them and motivate them to be different?
Well, I think first we have to start as a society defining what really is important. And we've screwed that up so much, so it's no surprise that our kids are all messed up. But, you know, what matters is who you are on the inside and what you do to make your world better. To me, that's the bottom line for everything, who you are on the inside and what you do to make your world better. And I say this all the time in court to adults. Would you go to the PTA meeting and tell them, I sell dope? And instinctively, all of them say no. Or I say, would you want your son or daughter to choose who you are right now? And instinctively, they say no. So if that's how we feel, we have got to do more as a society to start promoting what matters. And what matters is who you are on the inside, because if you concentrate on that, you want to be a decent person. So who you are on the inside and what you do to help others. But instead, we concentrate on all the things that don't matter, like what, how much stuff you have, how big your house is, what car you drive, you know, who has the most bodacious body, and all of those things. But at the end of the day, none of that really counts. And we get it as adults as we get older, because we're living this life and we go through all those feelings. But if we did a better job of help being real with kids and helping them get that sooner, then perhaps we won't be in this quandary of a situation that we're in our society with all of these ills. But I think it's because as adults, we're not really authentic with kids. we don't really share with them the deep down stuff that we felt as a child, that we've gone through. We don't sometimes even share with them our authentic feelings that we've gone through as an adult. And so that's why you saw in the video, and I do this every time I have this session with kids. It's never the same because I just kind of come off the cuff based upon the collection of kids I see. But I always try to find some aspect of my life that I can be real with them about, because when people can, one of the emails I got from the millions of people who saw this was a Jewish gentleman in Brooklyn, and he said, I want to share a Jewish saying with you. Words that emanate from the heart reach the heart. And that's why it's so important to be real, because when you're real with kids, when you truly share with them, they feel that, and that makes an impact. And so that's what we've got to do. To me, we've got to be real with kids. We've got to really share with them, and we've got to come from the depths of our heart, and that's the only way we'll make an impact. Because if you share from the depths of your heart, they can relate to that experience, something. So when I share it with them, I didn't say anything about my childhood this time, but I shared with them the fact that, you know, I know what it's like to be that parent, like their parents have been, and you get that call from the school, and you're a single parent, and because I'm divorced, you go back to your office, and you close the door, and you cry because you wonder, am I getting it right? Have I failed my child? Have my bad decisions led to my child not having what they need? And no, that's when those kids really broke down, because they could feel that. Because their parents probably sometimes told them or alluded to it, or maybe they heard them cry. But they can feel that. And at the end of the day, kids don't really want to hurt that one person, their go-to person. And so if I can prick their hearts, if we as a society can prick their hearts, we can begin to make the change. And people ask me, do you think these kids change the next day? Of course not. Do we change the next day? No. But what you hope is, given time and given some experience, something about something I said will prick their hearts. Some people, it may have changed that same day, but some it may take a week. Some of them may take the next experience of getting in trouble and bringing back to mind something I said. Who knows? Or maybe they'll be like me, a 50-year-old individual who gets a call from their teacher in high school, and although I thought this many days in my lifetime, for the first time, I tell her when she calls me, Miss Burke, you're the reason why I was able to fake it till I made it. Because when I started being a trial attorney, I was scared to death. And, you know, the accolades that I got from being a trial attorney, I never quite got those because, of course, deep internally, I always wonder, am I doing this right? Am I good enough? But she taught me the value of exuding confidence even when you question yourself. And being proud, even when you don't know if you have all it takes to exert that pride. And I just thanked her. I said, thank you for that, because you don't know how many days that kept me going. But I never reached back and told her. So some of these kids may end up going on to do great things, and they may never reach back to me. But if we pour into them, I know that will affect, you know, their lives and change them. Because all these letters I'm responding to, people have written me saying that. Somebody said something to them along the way that made a difference. Thank you for making a difference for these kids. But if we did that collectively, can you imagine?
Can you imagine? The voice of Judge Verda Colvin. You may have seen the viral video of her really lambasting and getting in line some young kids in a court. One more segment with Judge Colvin. Alex Cortez doing a great job as always on the interview. More with Our American Stories after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we're talking to Judge Verda Colvin. And she's a Superior Court judge in the state of Georgia. And we got to know her because of a viral video that was spreading across the web, which was a part of the Bibb County Sheriff's Office's Consider the Consequences program, a scared straight-style program for at-risk teens in Macon, Georgia. And she was tearing into some young people, and not in a mean way. She was just trying to get some sense into them and give them a motivational speech that they might just remember. We played a little bit before, and before we return back to the final part of Alex's great conversation with Judge Colvin, let's hear the rest of that viral video.
I'm telling you, if you don't make a goal for yourself, society's going to make one of these two options a goal. And I'm serious. I'm not telling you all anything different that I didn't tell my son. But you're going to have to make a decision that you're going to do something different. And don't use your family situation as an excuse. You hear me? Don't use that as an excuse. I don't know what's going on in your lives. I don't know where you live, but don't use it as an excuse. Anything either of you all are going through, somebody else went through it who's successful now. My mom made below the poverty level. She was a single mom, and my dad didn't help a whole lot. He did the bare minimum. But I didn't use that as a reason why I couldn't go to college. Guess what? If your parents don't have money, you can go to college almost free. That's the beauty of it. If you don't want to go to college, get a skill, but you've got to do something. I didn't allow my son to use the fact that his father wasn't in the house with us as an excuse. I didn't allow that, because what I told him is you have everything you need, because if you needed something else, you have it. And that's what you all got to know. Everything you need, you have. Young man, do you hear me? Everything you need, and look at you got a polo shirt on and sitting here because you messed up like that. Somebody cared enough about you to get that shirt. How old are you? And all this alternative school mess, this is ridiculous. See, you're already labeling yourself. When you go to alternative school, that's on your record. People see that. But even if you gotta be there, change the course. Start being different. So they can have attach something different to your name. Anybody can do nothing. Why would you want to do nothing? Anybody can do and be nothing.
What a great talk. She should be in every high school in America. And I mean every high school in America. Because everybody can do nothing. And we know those people all around us in our own families. And that's what's special about this. And so let's return now to our conversation, the final two parts. We're talking with Judge Verda Colvin about the video of her courtroom speech brought some troubled kids to tears. And by the way, as you watch this, you'll see them. Here's the conclusion of our interview between Judge Colvin and our own Alex Cortez, where they discuss mental health issues and dealing with mandatory minimum sentencing in her state of Georgia.
You have a passion for the mental health side of the court system. Why? And tell us about the types of cases and families and stories that come before you.
My mental health court for me is, and you know, I've often thought, should I say this publicly? But I'm going to say it because I pride myself on being authentic. Those people who come to you in mental health court become an extended part of your family in some ways, because I'm seeing them every 2 weeks, and it could be for over a year's time, depending on how long they have to stay in the program. And at their core, the best people you could ever meet. I mean, just really good folks. And so I am inspired and rejuvenated in trying to get them to see the value of medication, because what they end up learning is when I take my medicine, life is smooth sailing, or at least I don't get in trouble with law enforcement. When I don't take my medicine, I violate the law. And so I try to make them see that, but even more powerful than that is letting them know that they are whole just as they are. Because many times in society, and we're getting so much better, and I'm so proud of all the strides we've made, but many times they're led to believe that somehow they're less than because of that diagnosis. But I say this all the time, even in my regular courtrooms, none of us come here as perfect beings, and all of us have frailties, and all of us are struggling in some way. Some of ours are more public than others, but they're struggles nonetheless. So I try to truly get them to know that this doesn't make you less than. And you can do all the things you want to do. This doesn't have to stop your ability to dream and achieve those dreams. And to see people doing that, to see people believing that, we've had people go from doing nothing to being managers at restaurants to doing all these fabulous things. And I am so proud to be a part of that, because that's what it's all about. I think that's why we're here. That's why it's more than one person in the world. We're supposed to pour into each other and feed into each other. When someone next to me does well, I in turn do well. It's about empowering people, and that's, to me, what Mental Health Corps does. It empowers people to realize they can live a different life, and they don't have to be a part of the system. And I am so thankful that Governor Nathan Deal did the criminal justice reform, because that has been so much. I wouldn't be able to do this in Mental Health Corps had we not had this reformation in our criminal justice system.
Do you see too many of the people coming in through your court being locked up? I mean, is it frustrating at times you have your hands kind of tied by mandatory minimum laws at all?
Well, you know, in Georgia, because we've gone through the Criminal Reform Act, we don't have those kind of restraints for most of the situations that a lot of states do, because our governor has been so transformative in looking at this issue and recognizing that you can't lock your way out of our societal ills. We've got to address the ills. And so it is amazing to me that I came on the bench in this space and time, because to be quite honest with you, I have often thought, how would I be a judge on the bench before these criminal reform acts that Governor Deal has done? I don't know how I could have done it because of who I am and how I try to address the ills that the person comes before me with. Like, I will tell them, understand, I am no joke, and people, most of the defendants who come before me will tell you, I don't play, but I want to address what brought you here. I'm not looking to just put you in jail and give you time. That doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't do the person any good. It doesn't do our society any good. I want to address the ill that brought you here. So let's deal with that. Now, if I find that you don't care about addressing the ill and you don't want to, this may not be the route for you. You may have to do some jail time so you can come to yourself. But I'm going to try to address the ill as I see it before we get to that point. I'm not restricted like that. I feel like there are a lot of avenues for me to do what I want to do. The problem is resources, finding the resources to do all that we want to do. Because, you know, that we have a prison, coastal prison, that's designed to help people with substance abuse problems. But I keep wondering, if I send all my people there and other judges start really treating the ills versus just looking at the rap sheet, then that'll get full. And what do we do then? But, you know, we have to do what we can with what we have. And so I do feel like I have some things that are available that give me the opportunity to address the ills that come before me. I see the person who sits in front of me.
And there you have it. And great job again, Alex. And that's Judge Verda Colvin. And it's fascinating that in Texas and Georgia, in case you don't follow it, we do. And we love these stories that no one's talking about. Prison reform is on the top of mind for several reasons. A, look, these people come out again. They're part of our fabric. They're part of our country. And they're a valuable human resource. Second, it's a cost to keep people locked up. So the savings to the state and the taxpayers of Georgia has been tremendous. And Governor Deal is a Republican, but if this was a Democrat, we'd be giving that person credit. We follow issues here, not political parties. And as you're going to tell from our program, and we follow these issues all the way down the line, education, freedom, prison reform, economic freedom, and these are good things for all Americans once they know them. And it was interesting what Judge Colvin said about having the freedom to be able to do what she needed to do. By the way, this judge, I believe, would have quit if she had to just lock boys away because they were a number and she just had to sentence them. Why would you want to stay? Why be a judge? It's cookie cutter. You're just sitting there letting some rules of evidence in, some rules of evidence out. But at the key moment, after listening to all this stuff, after listening to the victims, because my goodness, the victims have a say in this. So does society. We always have to balance prison reform with keeping us safe. Always. There are some people we do not want back out on the streets. I know. I've worked in a public defender's office. And I've met them, especially sex crime predators. Some of them just can't help themselves. I met two when I was working in the Bergen County Public Defender's Office that begged me not to let them out ever because they were going to do it again. So that we know. We know those people should stay away and we should keep them in prison. But my goodness, this is the minority. This is the minority. And here are some facts, by the way, about prison reform in the state of Georgia. And it's pretty remarkable. And it has to do with just sheer numbers. The prison population in that state had doubled because of mandatory minimums from 1990 to 2010 to over 56,000 inmates. And you just can't keep doing that. It costs a fortune and it's lives lost. Prison population has dropped from 56,000 to under 52,000 since that time. So you didn't just stop the rate of increase, you stopped the numbers, and they want to keep going. By the way, they've dropped recidivism rates, and they've saved, let me get this right, $264 million to the people in projected savings. $264 million. That's a big number. Save lives, save money, freedom of judges to do what they need to do. And again, that's why we hate bureaucracies and just mass, vast bureaucracies where the human element is taken out. The human decision-making gets taken out. Judge Verda Colvin would not be the woman she is without prison reform. She said it. She meant it. And I believe she would have quit if she had to lock boys up for 10 years for a third low-level crime. Because it's just wrong and it makes no sense. This is Lee Habib. We bring you the kind of stories no one else is. And this is Our American Stories. Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And from time to time, we like to dig into the life of an artist. We did it with Martin Scorsese. We did it with Al Pacino. We did it with Merle Haggard, Johnny Cash, and on and on. And today, celebrating his life and the day he was born, Jack Nicholson. And by the way, he was born in a little New Jersey shore town called Neptune, not far from another guy who was born in a little shore town called Asbury Park. Strange that two iconic men like this could be born in that same region. And you had Bruce Willis and Frank Sinatra and a whole bunch of other big stars. And you start to say, what is it about New Jersey? And by the way, I could almost write a book about it because it's so close to New York City and yet it's so far away. And all these guys see the big lights. We heard Sinatra say it. There it was, the big city, and I was never going to belong. And it makes these guys incredibly ambitious. Crazy ambitious. They want to do big things. Jack Nicholson is the focus here, though, and he was born in 1937. And he kicked around like all actors do. And ultimately, if you Google it, you'll find out that he did some TV work in such great shows as The Andy Griffith Show and Dr. Kildare. Now, you wouldn't actually think of Jack Nicholson and The Andy Griffith Show. But he was an actor looking for work. And he wouldn't become the Jack Nicholson we came to know for quite some time. Quite some time. In fact, we're going to play you a clip right now from 1960, a performance of The Little Shop of Horrors. Now, this was the straight version. In 1986, Bill Murray would resuscitate this part in the musical version. But take a listen to the young Jack Nicholson.
My name is Wilberforce.
Wilberforce what?
Just Wilberforce. My first name is Wilbur. My last name is Force. I don't have a middle name.
Well, you have an appointment, maybe?
No, but you were very highly recommended to me by one of your patients, a Mrs. Eshiva. I do a lot of undertaking for her relatives.
Well, as you can see, I have a customer now, and I'm all booked up for the rest of the day, so you'll have to come back tomorrow.
Oh, I couldn't do that. I have 3 or 4 abscesses, a touch of pyorrhea, 9 or 10 cavities. I lost my pivot tooth, and I'm in terrible pain.
Well, I can't help you today.
Oh, that's all right. I'll just wait outside.
And by the way, if you watch this on YouTube, you're going to say, that guy was going to be one of the greatest actors of all time? No chance. No chance. By the way, he ends up winning 3 Oscars. Cuckoo's Nest, Terms of Endearment, and As Good as It Gets. And we learn that, except for Michael Caine, he's the only guy to have gotten an Oscar nod in every decade from the 60s through now. And that's unbelievable that he's had a career that spanned so many generations, and no matter what, the next generation thought he was really cool and really good. Really hard to do. Same with rock stars. I mean, what U2, Springsteen, and a couple of people in the Stones have done, it's remarkable to span 4 and 5 decades and still fill stadiums with people of all ages, across generations. A bit about Jack's life. He was raised believing that his grandmother was his mother, and that his mother, a showgirl, was his older sister. And by the way, this may explain Jack's penchant for being single. We're going to learn a little bit about where he is now. And it's actually a really sad place, and he's written about it, and he's been very public about what a life of chasing women has led to, which is a lot of loneliness, and actually really a real sadness and a lack of love in his life. And he's been very straight about it in an interview with the Daily Mail not too long ago, basically saying to young actors, don't live my life. I mean, it was fun for a while, but I don't have love in my life. By the way, Jack Nicholson didn't discover the truth about any of this until a 1975 Time magazine journalist was researching a profile on him. His real-life father is believed to have been either Donald Fraccillo, an Italian-American showman, or Eddie King, born in Latvia and also in show business. Jack's mother's ancestry was Irish, English, German, Scottish, and Welsh. And by the way, Jack did a whole bunch of B-movies before a couple of his B-movies became A-movies. And one of those first movies was a movie called Easy Rider, which nobody knew at the time would explode and create the careers of Dennis Hopper, Peter Fonda, an iconic soundtrack that no one ever forgot. Let's take a listen to Jack Nicholson's famous freedom speech.
You know, this used to be a hell of a good country. I can't understand what's going on with it. Man, everybody got chicken. That's what happened. Man. Hey, we can't even get into, like, a second-rate hotel. I mean, a second-rate motel, you dig? They think we're going to cut their throat or something, man. Like, they're scared, man. Oh, they're not scared of you. They're scared of what you represent to them. Amen. All we represent to them, man, is somebody who needs a haircut. Oh, no. What you represent to them is freedom.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it's all about, all right. But talking about it and being it, that's two different things. I mean, it's real hard to be free when you are bought and sold in the marketplace. Of course, don't ever tell anybody that they're not free, because then they're going to get real busy killing and maiming to prove to you that they are. Oh, yeah, they're going to talk to you and talk to you and talk to you about individual freedom. But they see a free individual, it's going to scare them.
No, well, don't make them running scared.
No, it makes them dangerous.
And that person that Jack Nicholson was talking to, of course, was Dennis Hopper, who would go on to have quite an illustrious film career as well. And these guys were nobodies. And by the way, that Steppenwolf song, Born to Be Wild, when those Harleys hit the road, it's one of those great iconic moments in American film history. And the beginning, I think, of the launch of the counterculture movement in this country. When we come back, 5 Easy Pieces, As Good As It Gets, Terms of Endearment. We're going to hear clips from all these. There's no better way to celebrate Jack's life than to hear, well, his performances. This is Our American Stories. More after these messages. The life of Jack Nicholson. This day in history. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. and that song by Steppenwolf, and that movie, Easy Rider, launched Jack Nicholson's career. And soon thereafter, in this particular film, Jack Nicholson was looking at his first Oscar nomination, the movie Five Easy Pieces. And in this scene, well, Jack is sort of an oil rigger. He's lost. He's made a lot of bad decisions in his life. Turns out he was trained by a classical musician, but didn't tell any of his rigger friends. And he had a really tough relationship with his dad. And now he's going back to try and see if he can heal it. His dad's out of it. He's in a wheelchair. He's in an open field. And a young Jack Nicholson, with a lot of regret, well, he tries to see what he can do to seal things up, make things better. Let's take a listen.
I don't know if you'd be particularly interested in hearing anything about me. My life, most of it doesn't add up to much that I could relate as a way of life that you'd approve of. I move around a lot. Not because I'm looking for anything really, but because I'm getting away from things that get bad if I stay. Auspicious beginnings, you know what I mean? I'm trying to imagine your half of this conversation. My feeling is, I don't know, that if you could talk, we wouldn't be talking. It's pretty much the way that it got to be before I left. Are you all right? I don't know what to say. Tina suggested that we try to, but I don't know. I think that she feels that we've got some understanding to reach. She totally denies the fact that we were never that comfortable with one another to begin with. The best that I can do is apologize. We both know that I was never really that good at it anyway. Sorry it didn't work out.
Sorry it didn't work out. And boy, what writing in Five Easy Pieces. There are a few scenes in this movie. Go back. Take a listen. By the way, what I love to do with my family, what I did in acting school, we would take an actor, the work of Marlon Brando, whatever, start with his first movie and get right to the last movie and do them in order. Or a director, Billy Wilder. Get the first movie, go to the last. You learn more about film watching film that way than any other way I could think of. And it's so easy now with Netflix. But that line, I move around a lot. Not because I'm looking for anything in particular, but because if I stay, things will get bad. Ouch. I think that's Jack's life in a lot of ways, too. He never really did settle down. There's a lot of that character in Jack, and there's a lot of all of these characters are in Jack, deeply. Next movie up, As Good As It Gets. We want to get light. And my goodness, was this a funny movie. And Jack was just great. He's still that same woman-chasing curmudgeon, but with a lot more charm. And this is the scene where a young writer is just pouring her heart out to Jack. Oh, you're so wonderful. And he's just had enough of it. He's got finally a girl on his mind, Helen Hunt. So he doesn't want the attention from these young fans anymore. And well, he just wants to get away from her. And she just wants a piece of him. Let's take a listen.
I can't resist. You usually move through here so quickly, and I just have so many questions I want to ask you. You have no idea what your work means to me.
What does it mean to you?
That somebody out there knows what it's like to be in here.
Oh, God, this is like a nightmare.
Oh, come on, just a couple of questions. How hard is that? How do you write women so well?
I think of a man, and I take away reason and accountability.
And it doesn't get better than that. And another movie that just, well, it was just so darn good. And Jack was so good in it. And his co-star was Shirley MacLaine. And it's Terms of Endearment. And he plays Garrett Breedlove, a sort of a washed out ex-astronaut who's still trading on his astronaut status with all the young girls. And he has this next door neighbor, Shirley MacLaine, who's older. And she's always watching him stumbling drunk in and out of his Corvette with different 20-year-olds. And yet she's intrigued. And finally she comes over to the door and knocks and basically asks him out on a date. And he's like actually a little disturbed, but he figures what the heck. They go on a date. And, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But let's just hear the As Good As It Gets first before we then hear the Shirley MacLaine. We'll do both. Here's that Lothario Jack Nicholson with Helen Hunt at a dinner table.
Here I go. Clearly a mistake. I've got this, what, ailment. My doctor, a shrink that I used to go to all the time, he says that in 50 or 60% of the cases, a pill really helps. I hate pills. Very dangerous thing, pills. Hate. I'm using the word hate here about pills. Hate. My compliment is that night when you came over and told me that you would never... All right, well, you were there. You know what you said. Well, my compliment to you is the next morning I started taking the pills.
I don't quite get how that's a compliment for me.
You make me want to be a better man.
That's maybe the best compliment of my life.
Well, maybe I overshot a little because I was aiming at just enough to keep you from walking out.
And Nicholson won an Oscar for that one. And now back to that aforementioned Terms of Endearment scene. And again, it's always Jack Nicholson with women problems. Always. It's a running theme in so many of his movies. It's especially the serious ones. And so they've just gone on their date. Jack Nicholson has made a mess of it. In fact, if you remember the beach scene, she wants to just get home and he takes her out on the beach and just starts tearing down the beach at like 80 miles an hour and her hair is all over the place and he just wants to blow the date up and just have her never bug him again. They pull back into the house. He stumbles out of the car. She gets out of the car and, well, let's take it from here.
Just look great. Fine. Great. You're parked in my driveway. You're breaking the law. Thank you.
Would you like to come in?
I'd rather stick needles in my eyes.
Everything would have been just fine, you know, if you hadn't gotten drunk. I mean, I just didn't want you to think I was like one of your other girls.
What is it that makes you so insistent on shocking and insulting me?
I mean, I really hate that way of talking. You must know that. Why do you do it?
I'll tell you, Rory. I don't know what it is about you, but you do bring out the devil in me.
This is Lee Habib, the life of Jack Nicholson. We're celebrating it through his movies and clips. When we come back, more The Departed, And, of course, A Few Good Men. More after this.
Soft fits, I tell you, to dump a body in the marsh, you dump them in the marsh. Not where some guy from John Hancock goes every Thursday. Don't laugh! This ain't reality TV!
And that is Frank Costello. That's the character that Jack Nicholson played in The Departed. A terrific Martin Scorsese movie, and boy, Leo DiCaprio, what a star. He's just such a star. And let's listen now. We're down to our top five. The crew put together the top five. I'm sure you have yours. But here's now number five, top Jack Nicholson scenes in movies. This one is the Chinese mob scene in The Departed.
All right, turn off your cell phones. Fitzy's got the chicken. Check your weapons. How you going, Rob?
Good, Mr. Costello. I want to tell you, these gents have machine guns.
你有没有搞错啊？我等，又等，又再等，我差唔多走咗啦。呢个先生喺政府嚟嘅大佬，佢俾人捉啊，佢一定要自杀，成个家庭俾人杀死晒啊，大佬。
He's from the Chinese government. I mean, he's just scared.
Government man. Scared. I'm concerned about a Chinaman who thinks it's wise to come to a business transaction with automatic weapons.
大佬担心噶，嚟咗真你哋大陆度，要带啲机关枪嚟做生意交易。
For his own good, tell Bruce Lee and the Karate Kids none of us are carrying automatic weapons. Because here, in this country, it don't add inches. You get a life sentence for it.
喂，你啲黐线啊！你快啲收啲机关枪啊！快啲啦，收起啦！放枪。
If these chinks want to nuke Taiwan anytime in the century, they better shape up and show me
$1 million.
What we generally do in this country is one guy brings the items and the other guy pays him. No ticky, no laundry.
And Jack, well, what can you say about that performance? Catch the movie. You just can't stop watching it once it's on the TV. It's almost like The Godfather for me now. Next up, number four, Batman, the scene where Jack Nicholson plays the Joker, and it's the boardroom scene as Jack Napier.
So, gentlemen, that's how it is. Until Grissom resurfaces. I'm the acting president, and I say, starting with this anniversary festival, we run the city into the ground.
Why don't we hear this from Grissom?
Yeah. And what's with that stupid grin?
Life's been good to me.
What if we say no?
Nobody wants a war. If we can't do business, why, we'll just shake hands and that'll be it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Woo! Woo! Oh, I got a live one here. Oh, there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. Antoine got a little hot under the collar.
You're crazy.
Had you ever heard of the healing power of laughter?
Now get out of here!
I don't think anyone has as many great laughs as Jack Nicholson. Is there a good soundboard for him, Jesse? There's got to be a...
We'll check it out.
Just all the laughter, and maybe on the bumps we can get different Jack Nicholson laughs, because you think about all the movies, my goodness, and we were just talking about Jack's facial manners, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. But now we're hitting number three, and it's another Oscar-winning performance. It's the World Series fight scene. R.P. McMurphy... One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
All right, all I need is one vote, right? Right?
All right.
Okay. Want to watch the World Series? Come on in, pal. This could be a big moment for you. Now, you want to watch a baseball game? You want to watch baseball? Just raise that hand up. Just raise the hand up. What do you say? Sorry. Bantini, old horse. What do you say? You want to watch the ball game on TV? Huh? Want to watch the ball game? Baseball? World Series? What do you say, pal? You're tired? Just raise your hand up, Bantini. Watch the ball game, huh? Okay, all right. What about you, pal? All we need is one vote. Just one vote. Just your one vote. That's all we need. Just raise your hand up and your buddies can watch the baseball game. General, you remember, don't you? October, the banner, the stars. Oh, say can you, the World Series. Raise your hand up, by the dawn's early. Just raise your hand up, what about you, pal, huh? Want to watch the ball game? Want to watch the ball game, huh? Just one vote. Just raise your...
Gentlemen, the meeting is adjourned.
For Christ's sake, isn't there one of you fucking maniacs that knows what I'm talking about?
Mr. McMurphy.
Huh?
The meeting is adjourned.
All right, just wait a minute, will you? Just one minute?
You can bring the subject up again tomorrow.
All right, Chief. You're our last chance. What do you say, huh? Just raise your hand up. That's all we need from you today, Chief. Just raise your hand up one time. Show her that you can do it. Just show her that you can still do it. Just raise your hand up. All the guys have got them up. Just raise your hand up, Chief, will you? Huh? Come on, there's got to be one guy in here that's not a total
nut.
Mac? Chief! The chief! Ah! Chief! There's Ratchet! There's Ratchet! Look! Look! The chief put his hand up! The chief put his hand up! Look, he voted! Would you please turn the television set on?
Into the tub room,
the chief
please.
Has got his
Come
hand
on,
up right there.
Get in.
The chief voted. Now, will you please turn the television set on?
Mr. McMurphy... The meeting was adjourned and the vote was closed.
But the vote was 10-8. The chief, he's got his hand up. Look.
No, Mr. McMurphy. When the meeting was adjourned, the vote was 9-9.
Ah, come on. You're not going to say that now. You're not going to say that now. You're going to pull that handheld shit now. When the vote, the chief just voted, it was 10-9. Now, I want that television set turned on right now.
And no one had ever seen anything like that before, I think. And this is what makes the greats, doing a performance like no one had ever seen. And that's Jack.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And we're running out of time here in this segment. We've got two more to go. We're not going to tell you which. I think you know one of them, because I think you can't, in the end, close without it. But we're going to wait. And then we're going to also talk a little bit about what you're not seeing, because it's Jack's facial mannerisms. It's what he does with his body. And we're going to talk a little about the athletic nature of being an actor. In the same way that you can only get so good in basketball and reach your peak, some people are born with Michael Jordan's instrument, and then they make the most of it. And Jack Nicholson had an amazing film instrument. He never bothered with Broadway. He never tried to conquer the theater. He knew he was a man of the film arts, a man for the big screen, and only the big screen. This is Lee Habib, Jack Nicholson, his life story, his life celebrated, because on this day in history, in 1937 in Neptune, New Jersey, the Jersey Shore, Jack Nicholson was born. One last segment, and the final two in this countdown after these messages.
Are you waiting for me to say something? Give me hope, you gotta do better than you're doing.
Look, you.
I'm very intelligent.
So never, never interrupt me, okay?
And if you can't be at least mildly interesting, then shut the hell up.
Well, I work all the time.
You should answer someone when they speak to you. Maybe we could live without the wisecracks.
And that's just Jesse doing a little mashup of our favorite Nicholson shorts.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
No.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
We got to stop the madness.
That's right.
That's right.
That's correct.
So, Jack, what do you think of our final countdown here? Do you think Witches of Eastwick should be number two?
Is there another kind?
Well, let's take a listen. This is a masterpiece of acting. Jack Nicholson tries to, of course...
Thank you.
Jack Nicholson tries to, of course, bed these three beautiful women, and ultimately they figure out who he really is, just a nasty Lothario. And so they seek their revenge, and there's nothing like three women scorned. And Nicholson, in the end, stumbles into this church, and everybody's horrified, and he's exposed, and he's angry. And let's take a listen to Daryl Van Horn.
Ask you something. You're all church-going folk. I really want to ask you something. Do you think God knew what he was doing when he created woman? Huh? I really want to know. Or do you think it was just another one of his minor mistakes, like tidal waves, earthquakes, floods? You think women are like that? What's the matter? You don't think God makes mistakes? Of course he does. We all make mistakes. Of course, when we make mistakes, they call it evil. When God makes mistakes, they call it nature. So what do you think? Women... a mistake? Or did he do it to us on purpose? Because I really want to know. Because if it's a mistake, maybe we could do something about it. Find a cure. Invent a vaccine. Build up our immune systems. Get a little exercise. You know, 20 push-ups a day, and you never have to be afflicted with women ever again.
And it's just a master performance. It's over the top. It's deliberate. It's a spoof. He's sort of the devil in this. And he gets what he deserves in the end. And he often does in these movies. And of course, that brings us to the last one. And of course, it just has to be this one. And it's his performance in A Few Good Men. And his performance on the stand as Colonel Nathan Jessup.
Defense will be calling Airman Cecil O'Malley and Airman Anthony Rodriguez. They were working the ground crew at Andrews at 2 a.m. on the 7th.
Your Honor, these men weren't on the list.
Rebuttal witnesses, Your Honor, called specifically to refute testimony offered under direct examination.
I'll allow the witnesses.
This is ridiculous.
Colonel, a moment ago,
check the tower logs.
Well, we'll get to the airmen in just a minute, sir. A moment ago, you said that you ordered Lieutenant Kendrick to tell his men that Santiago wasn't to be touched.
That's right.
And Lieutenant Kendrick was clear on what you wanted?
Crystal.
Any chance Lieutenant Kendrick ignored the order?
Ignored the order?
Any chance he forgot about it?
No.
Any chance Lieutenant Kendrick left your office and said, the old man is wrong?
No.
When Lieutenant Kendrick spoke to the platoon and ordered them not to touch Santiago, any chance they ignored him?
You ever served in an infantry unit, son?
No, sir.
Ever served in a forward area?
No, sir.
Ever put your life in another man's hands? Asked him to put his life in yours?
No, sir.
We follow orders, son. We follow orders or people die. It's that simple. Are we clear?
Yes, sir.
Are we clear?
Crystal. Colonel, I have just one more question before I call Airman O'Malley and Airman Rodriguez. If you gave an order that Santiago wasn't to be touched, and your orders are always followed, then why would Santiago be in danger? Why would it be necessary to transfer him off the base?
Santiago was a substandard Marine. He was being transferred.
That's not what you said. You said he was being transferred because he was in grave danger.
That's correct.
You said he was in danger. I said grave danger. You said, is there any.
I recall what I said.
I can have the court reporter read back to you.
I know what I said. I don't have to have it read back to me like I'm.
Why the two orders? Colonel?
Sometimes men take matters into their own hands.
No, sir. You made it clear just a moment ago that your men never take matters in their own hands. Your men follow orders or people die. So Santiago shouldn't have been in any danger at all, should he have, Colonel?
You snotty little...
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
If Lieutenant Kendrick gave an order that Santiago wasn't to be touched, then why did he have to be transferred? Colonel? Lieutenant Kendrick ordered the code red, didn't he? Because that's what you told Lieutenant Kendrick to do.
Object!
And when it went bad, you cut these guys loose!
Your Honor, you had
markers inside a bony transfer!
Your Honor,
you doctored the logbook!
Damn, Captain!
You coerced the doctor!
Consider yourself in contempt!
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth! Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's gonna do it? You? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago, and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know, that Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives. You don't want the truth because deep down in places you don't talk about at parties, you want me on that wall. You need me on that wall. We use words like honor, code, loyalty. We use these words as the backbone of a life spent defending something. You use them as a punchline. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. Otherwise, I suggest you pick up a weapon and stand a post. Either way, I don't give a damn what you think you are entitled to.
Did you order the code red?
I did the job.
Did you order the code red?
You're damn right I did.
What a scene. My goodness, it plays on radio. You're just brought into it. What writing? Conflict, passion. And I don't know anyone who could have done that better than Jack. It's just crazy good. It's crazy good. And Tom Cruise, what happens when you act with Jack Nicholson is your game goes up. Everybody's better around him. And actor after actor, there was a great AFI tribute to Jack Nicholson. And he doesn't like to speak in public. By the way, our team looked, as you know, we love finding interviews. Jack Nicholson didn't do any. I couldn't find one. He never went on the Charlie Rose show. He never sat down with the folks in the art festivals. He doesn't show up. He did have to appear before all of his peers at the American Film Institute, giving him the Lifetime Achievement Award. He had his speech ready to go, threw the cards up in the air. Everybody laughed. He stumbled a little bit and got off the stage. Just wasn't interested in talking about his craft to anybody. And that's why we played the clips. And Greg was a young actor, and I spent some time in acting school, and a couple of my favorites of his also include Pritzi's Honor, There's No One Great Scene, Broadcast News, The Pledge, About Schmidt. But what did you walk away with watching Nicholson as a young actor? And I know for me, it just got me so depressed because he just did things I knew I could never do.
Yeah, it's all in the inner life that he has. And even in that scene where he says, you can't handle the truth, I was like, it was powerful. But I think it's only powerful because you've seen him perform it. You see that face and the intenseness. You see when he pulls down his jacket after they're getting ready to handcuff him. You see when the judge says, you don't have to answer that, and the left eyebrow comes up. All that inner life that you see, that's what makes it powerful. And if you type it in on YouTube, you say greatest scenes, the things that come up are De Niro's close-up where he's not saying one word and his eyebrow comes up when he's smoking a cigarette because he's thinking about killing one of the guys that he knows. And another one is Pacino in Scent of a Woman where he's getting chewed out by his family member and he's just sitting there at the table. Look, that they're titled greatest scenes and they're not saying a thing.
Yep, and I think that's what made Nicholson Nicholson. It's what he did when he wasn't speaking, and even when he was speaking, what he did with his body and how the words, as we learned from Sinatra, came from inside and then out. And there are not many talents like him. He's still with us, and they're celebrating his amazing life. Born April 22nd, 1937, again in a small town on the Jersey Shore. The life of Jack Nicholson. This is Our American Stories. And you've got your favorites. Send them to us. But those were ours, and we stand by them. More after these messages.
This is ridiculous. I have neither the time nor the inclination to explain myself. I'm going to get on a plane and go on back to my base.